During Bill Clinton's first 7 years in office, the Secret Service made arrangements for 2,500 appearances in more than 800 cities in the United States and abroad, as well as 450 appearances.
Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, the unscripted show that celebrates unsung heroes, myth busts historical lies, and rediscovers the forgotten stories that changed our world. I'm your host, Scott Rank.
Was tracking a list of several thousand Americans who were considered presidential threats. More than 400 were on the watch list of dangerous individuals. Several hundred weapons were detected each year, almost all of them carried lawfully by people who had state permits. Those who were discovered to be carrying weapons illegally were usually taken to police headquarters and charged with a misdemeanor. There were a number of incidents that the media characterized as threats against the president, but were unconnected to any assassination attempt. But one incident stands out. In the early morning of September 12, 1994, a Cessna 150L airplane crashed onto the south lawn of the White House, killing the pilot, 38-year-old Frank Eugene Corder, but injuring no one else. The plane came to a halt against the south wall of the White House, causing minimal damage. President Clinton and his family were not home at the time. The Clintons were spending the night across Pennsylvania Avenue at Blair House while White House workers repaired faulty ductwork. There was no evidence Corder, who had been drinking and smoking crack cocaine at the time he flew the plane, ever intended to kill Clinton or had been angry with his policies. Rather, according to informed associates, he simply wanted to die crashing his plane into the White House. Corder may have failed in his task of threatening the president, but he certainly received the media attention that he sought. Well, Corder is just one of thousands of people who threatened the life of the president. And this is true for Clinton. This is true for presidents who came before and after him. So as you can see, the Secret Service has a very difficult mission. It's nearly impossible for it and other law enforcement agencies to predict criminal behavior by previously law-abiding people or to know when criminals or people with mental illnesses might suddenly become violent. Sometimes you have activists with passionate rhetoric. Sometimes you have activists who threaten general violence against the president, but what they're saying still barely falls under First Amendment speech protections. Sometimes you have people who go beyond that and specifically threaten the life of the president and right into the White House. And then the Secret Service has to wonder, is this a serious threat? Is this a prankster? Is this someone who's off their medication? Or is this someone we should really track? Singling out violent political fanatics is also problematic. Contrary to popular belief, most American assassins and would-be assassins aren't motivated solely or even primarily by deep political convictions. Sirhan Sirhan, Robert F. Kennedy's assassin, was certainly motivated by political fanaticism, but also by a deep desire for fame and notoriety. Several episodes ago on this podcast, I talked with Mel Eitan, who's the author of the book Hunting the President, and we skim the surface of this topic of the profile of people who go after presidents. Well, what I want to do is do a few episodes focusing on the threats that individual presidents received, how close some presidents came to actually being assassinated, and what kind of people targeted each president. Did Barack Obama, for example, attract a different type of assassin than Bill Clinton, or were all these people cut from the same cloth? Well, the answer to that question can tell us a lot about political violence and fanaticism. And we can also see that many would-be assassins are bumbling and inept and trying to seek fame and notoriety in the fastest way possible, mostly due to the fact that they were failed upstarts in life. And I'd like to thank Mel Eitan for the contributions he gave to the series by letting me use his research. And what he found is that the overwhelming majority of the assassins, would-be assassins, and threateners went after the president due to personal misfortune, mental health problems, or desire for fame, rather than political motive. According to one researcher hired for a Secret Service study of would-be assassins, it was very, very rare for the primary motive to be political, though there were a number of attackers who appeared to clothe their motives with some political rhetoric. Professor James Clark believes Francisco Duran, President Clinton's attacker, didn't target Clinton because of his policies, Rather, Duran wanted to kill the commander-in-chief, a person who just happened to be Bill Clinton. Had he been re-elected in 1992, George Bush might have been that symbol. It was President Clinton's position and prominence, not his policies, that determined Duran's course of action. A 1999 Secret Service study found that American assassins embarked on assassination schemes for a variety of reasons, including to bring attention to a personal or public problem, to avenge a perceived wrong, to end personal pain, to save the country or the world, as they so think, to develop a special relationship with a target, or simply to make money. The report concluded, none of the assassins or would-be assassins were models of emotional well-being. Many of the people studied for the report were experiencing or had experienced serious mental health issues. 44% had a history of depression, 43% a history of delusional ideas, and 21% heard voices. But as co-author of the study Robert Fine said, the way these people sought to address what they saw as their main problem, failure in life, was not inherently crazy. So in this series, we're going to be looking at a number of presidential administrations, starting with Franklin Roosevelt and then moving on up through history to JFK, Ronald Reagan, and Barack Obama. Presidents with different policies, different backgrounds, and we're going to see if they attract similar or different types of would-be assassins, and how close were these presidents to death? Did some of them just barely escape death and we don't know about it? That's what we'll look into. The reason we're starting with FDR is because that's when the Secret Service is established. Now, of course, unsuccessful and unsuccessful presidential assassination attempts happened long before FDR. A new president in the United States is assassinated approximately once every 20 to 40 years. The four presidents who were killed include Abraham Lincoln in 1865, James Garfield in 1881, William McKinley in 1901, and JFK in 1963. Now, as you can see by the numbers, there was a rapid clip from the 1860s and 1900, but for the last nearly 120 years, there's only been one successful assassination. That's partly due to the formation of the U.S. Secret Service, a federal law enforcement agency under the U.S. Department of Homeland Security that conducts criminal investigations and protects the nation's leaders. The Secret Service was established in 1865, but its main job at the time was to suppress counterfeit currency. But in the early 20th century, it realized that it needed to step up to protect the life of the president. William McKinley was assassinated in 1901, and in 1909, President Taft, when he met with Mexican President Porfirio Diaz in El Paso, Texas, the small Secret Service realized that it had insufficient forces to protect the president at the historic summit, and they had to call in the Texas Rangers and U.S. troops. So over the decades, the Secret Service grew and grew, and the number of people that it protected also grew. If we jump to 1968, we see that Congress authorized protection of major presidential and vice presidential candidates and nominees, not just the person of the president, following the Robert F. Kennedy assassination. Congress also authorized lifetime protection of the spouses of deceased presidents unless they remarried, and they protected the children of former presidents until age 16. Now, there are over 7,000 employees of the Secret Service, and they have an annual budget of over $2 billion. Part of the reason also we're starting with Roosevelt is that the archives of the Secret Service and accounts of Secret Service agents grow as the numbers of people in the agency grow. So FDR is a good starting point with all of this. Franklin Roosevelt once said, "Since you can't control these things," and he was talking about assassination threats, "you don't worry about them." Well, that was a great attitude to have, because he was the target of many would-be assassins during his four terms, leading a country during the Great Depression and World War II. These threatened to bomb his train, blow up the White House, and simply shoot him. Like many presidents, most of these threats were the rantings of mentally ill individuals, drunks, or attention seekers, but some of the threats were considered extremely dangerous by FDR's protectors. Roosevelt received an average of 40,000 letters a month. 5,000 of those were threatening. According to the chief of the White House Secret Service detail, Michael Riley, the greatest threat to the president came not from the foreign agents or American traitors, but from people who are just, he called them, plain nuts. Riley singled out Los Angeles as the most dangerous city for the president. As he said, it had more nuts per acre than any other American city. In 1937, President Roosevelt appointed Frank J. Wilson as Secret Service chief. Wilson is sometimes called the father of the modern Secret Service because of the way he improved the president's security after the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. Wilson's security procedures remained the Secret Service standard until the 1980s. Now, if you're a Secret Service agent, you see the president up close and personal in a way that almost nobody else does in Washington, outside of the president's family. Only in the last decade or two have former agents started writing about their time with presidents, and these are an incredible source of information to see what a president was like in their regular life. Secret Service agents got along differently with different presidents. Some presidents treated them harshly, some simply ignored them and thought of them as wallpaper, but others had a good rapport with them. And FDR was the latter. The agents affectionately called Roosevelt the boss, and he returned their affection. According to Riley, when you did something for him that he felt was either a favor or a task well done, he told you about it. Riley wrote, "On the one hand, if you erred, he let you know he was displeased. Quietly, but thoroughly." Riley in his detail believed FDR was a nice guy, but recognized the aristocratic Roosevelt would never be one of the boys, although he frequently made a good try. Riley said that Roosevelt was imbued with a pleasant manner, but he could be ruthless when he desired. Well, the Secret Service detail was often the target of FDR's practical jokes. President Roosevelt drove his own car, a Ford that had been fitted with hand controls because of his disability. During these trips, he frequently played pranks on his agents and would try to lose them on his drives in the country at Hyde Park or Warm Springs. On his return, he would ask his head of detail, Colonel Edmund Starling, "Ed, I have lost the Secret Service boys. I can't find them anywhere. Do you know where they are?" Even aside from pranks to elude his security detail, FDR was difficult to guard because, as Starling observed, the president was utterly fearless, contemptuous of danger, and full of desire to go places and do things, preferably unorthodox places and unorthodox things, for a president. This was also compounded by FDR's polio. He contracted it in 1921, and his legs were locked in steel braces. When walking, he swung one leg in an arc, moved forward, and swung the other leg. For his first inaugural speech in 1933, he walked 37 paces in this manner to a lectern. In 1936, when he walked to a podium at Philadelphia's Franklin Field to give his acceptance speech to the Democratic Party convention delegates, he fell in the mud before an audience of 100,000. Secret Service agents quickly surrounded him to shield him from photographers in the crowd. FDR fell at least three times in public during his presidency, but the incidents were kept out of the press. This was tricky for his handlers because the president's disability meant he couldn't easily escape a fire. In fact, the idea of being trapped by fire was always at the back of FDR's mind. Michael Riley said that the president was completely fearless except for fire. The Secret Service considered the White House to be the biggest fire trap in America, bar none. If an arsonist or fire struck the White House, the president's agent would carry him downstairs, avoiding the elevators, which had a habit of stalling. Agents always carried canvas fire chutes that could be dropped through a window from the president's bedroom in case the stairs were aflame. Many fringe groups made the president a hate figure, including the fascist cocky shirts of America, the fascist silver shirts, the Ku Klux Klan, and a Ku Klux Klan splinter group, the Black Legion, which was centered in Ohio and Michigan. There was also a group of financiers and industrialists who threatened the president, who in 1934 allegedly plotted a coup d'etat to prevent FDR from establishing what they feared would be a socialist state. Though the media regarded it as a tall tale, retired Marine Corps Major General Smedley Butler testified before a congressional committee that the conspirators had wanted Butler to deliver an ultimatum to FDR to create a new cabinet officer, a Secretary of General Affairs, who had run things while the president recuperated from feigned ill health. Roosevelt refused. The conspirators had promised General Butler an army of 500,000 war veterans who would help drive Roosevelt from the office. The so-called Wall Street Putsch was mocked by major newspapers. The New York Times said the alleged plot was a gigantic hoax and a bald and unconvincing narrative. While it is true that the Congressional Committee investigation led to no prosecutions, Butler's testimony was later corroborated by veteran of foreign wars commander James Van Zandt and by testimony in the congressional hearings, which were made public in 1967. Although most historians have dismissed the alleged plot as no more than wild talk, investigative journalist Sally Denton, in her book The Plots Against the President, provide compelling evidence that the plotters were rather serious. Denton claims historians have unjustly understated the serious nature of plans to overthrow the Roosevelt administration. In 1938, 4 years after the alleged plot to topple Roosevelt, a speaker at a Chicago meeting of the Silver Shirt Legion of America was quoted as saying, America would have a dictator in less than a year, and, quote, if no one else will volunteer to kill him, I will do it myself. Well, the Secret Service investigated, but no arrests were made for lack of substantial evidence. According to Cornelius Vanderbilt Jr., who was the great-great-grandson of the famous industrialist Commodore Cornelius Vanderbilt, there was a second plot among rich industrialists to depose Roosevelt after his unprecedented third-term election in 1940. Vanderbilt wrote, I use the word conspiracy, and I really am talking of a plot, serious, long-discussed plan to, shall I say, capture the president. Vanderbilt said the plan was to impose a firm restraint for the good of the country, to hold this dictator, this madman, while some person set up emergency controls and saved America. Vanderbilt informed federal agencies of the plot, and they in turn let him warn those involved in this cable. Accordingly, the plot never took off. Vanderbilt said FDR knew about the conspiracy. The story was reported in 1959, and the then head of the Secret Service, U.E. Bowman, said he never heard of the alleged conspiracy, and FDR's Secret Service chief, Frank J. Wilson, also denied any recollection of it. In late 1941, there was more talk of plots against the president when the FBI reported that Ethel Brigham, an America First Committee member, said that if Roosevelt took the country to war, a group called the One Gun Club would rise up and revolt. The information was pure rumor, but this didn't stop the FBI from loose surveillance on the Brigham family. FBI agents reported that Mrs. Brigham attended a New York play where she was observed to make anti-Roosevelt remarks, but nothing more came of it. Roosevelt, who was a patrician politician, was used to threats against his life. During the First World War, when he was Assistant Secretary of the Navy, he was a target of a bomb sent in the mail. It was discovered before it reached him. Roosevelt was also in harm's way when anarchists tried to bomb Attorney General Mitchell Palmer's home in 1919, but ended up blowing up themselves when the bomb exploded prematurely. Roosevelt lived across the street from Palmer and was home when the bomb exploded, blowing out all the front windows of his residence. Another bomb threat occurred in April 1929, shortly after he had been inaugurated as governor of New York. A bomb was accidentally discovered by a porter, Thomas Calagy, in the parcel room at the General Post Office in New York City. The parcel was addressed to Governor Roosevelt, and the sender's address turned out to be a fictitious one. The bomb consisted of 6 ounces of dynamite packed in a 6-inch-long pipe that was capped at both ends and contained a fuse with a detonating device. The bomb was embedded in a tin candy box wrapped in brown paper. The detonator was a strip of sandpaper against which 4 matches were held by a spring. As Calagy swept the mailroom floor, he accidentally hit the parcel with his broom. It began to hiss and smoke, but failed to detonate. Calagy immediately stepped on the bomb to stamp out the fuse. Police later surmised that the device was designed to scare rather than kill, but also believed that the bomb might be linked to the burning of Roosevelt's son-in-law's house in Mount Pleasant. Both crimes remained unsolved. Hey everyone, Scott here. I want to take a brief break from this episode to talk about how you can both support this show and get free, incredible food delivered right to your door. I'd like to talk about a company I've tried out called HelloFresh, which is a meal kit delivery service that shops, plans, and delivers step-by-step recipes and pre-measured ingredients so you can just cook, eat, and enjoy. If you have goals for 2019 that involve either eating healthier or making more awesome food, then HelloFresh will help you knock out both of those. Cooking at home is enjoyable and easy with HelloFresh because all you have to do is follow 6-step pictured recipe cards and put in the pre-measured ingredients and you're good to go. The meals come together in 30 minutes max. They call for less than 2 pots and pans and require minimal cleanup. I've made food using HelloFresh and my kids said it looked like something that came out of a restaurant, which is something that I'd never been complimented with before. You have 3 plans to choose from, the classic, the veggie, and the family, with the option to switch between for when your tastes change. And you can enjoy menu features like HelloFresh's 20-minute meals, gourmet, and one-pot wonders. One recipe I really enjoyed making was the chicken and pineapple quesadillas. Probably one of my favorite sweet and savory combos I've ever made, and something this recipe illustrates in general about HelloFresh that I really like, is that the recipes are interesting and get you out of your rut, but they're not so exotic that they turn off anyone who isn't an extreme foodie or you have to make food for your kids. So it really strikes that balance between being interesting and working for a lot of different people. Take advantage of HelloFresh's special offer for 2019. Get $80 off your first month by going to HelloFresh.com/unplugged80, that's 8-0 the numerals, and enter the promo code unplugged80. That's HelloFresh.com/unplugged80 and enter the promo code unplugged80. It's like getting 8 meals for free because you get $20 off your first 4 boxes. So one last time, go to HelloFresh.com/unplugged80 and enter the promo code unplugged80. Franklin Roosevelt was elected president in 1932. In the 3 months he spent as president-elect, FDR was a target of an Italian anarchist and another deranged bomber. On February 15, 1933, while on a fishing trip with Vincent Astor, Roosevelt gave an impromptu speech at Miami's Bayfront Park. FDR was in a green Buick convertible, the lead car of a 3-car motorcade. With Roosevelt in the Buick were Secret Service agent Gus Genrich, press aide Marvin McIntyre, and Miami Mayor B. Gauthier. FDR didn't leave his car, but stood addressing the crowd. He spoke less than 2 minutes. In the audience was Chicago Mayor Anton Cermak, who stepped over to shake Roosevelt's hand. Somebody then handed Roosevelt a telegram, and as the president reached to take it, an Italian immigrant named Giuseppe Zangara stood on a chair amidst the crowd and opened fire with a nickel-plated .32-caliber double-action revolver. Although the shots missed FDR, a bullet came within 2 feet of his head. Mayor Cermak was hit, along with 4 others in the crowd. Roosevelt told his Secret Service agents to put Cermak in the presidential car and held the fatally wounded mayor on the way to the hospital. Zangara pleaded guilty to 4 counts of assault and was sentenced to 80 years in prison. When Mayor Cermak died on March 6, Zangara was tried a second time. He again pleaded guilty and received the death sentence. During his trial, Zangara said he thought he had the right to kill him. "I see Mr. Hoover, I kill him first. Make no difference who go get that job. Run by big money. I'm sorry Roosevelt's still alive. I want to shoot Roosevelt." Zangara's self-proclaimed mission was to kill kings and presidents first, and next all capitalists. As an aside, it was also an anarchist that killed William McKinley. The anarchists were behind a number of political assassinations in the early 20th century, as Western society is still moving from monarchy to democratic forms of government, and the messy transition to industrialism made some people suspicious of all elite forms of power, whether you were a plutocrat or a captain of an industry or a president. And those people marginalized were often attracted to anarchism and became would-be assassins like this. Zangara was electrocuted with 230 volts from Rayford Prison's Old Sparky, surging through his body at 9:27 a.m. on March 20th. His last words were, "Viva Italia! Goodbye to all poor people everywhere! Push the button! Go ahead, push the button!" Many were convinced Zangara was not a lone wolf, but had been hired by Chicago gangster Frank Nitti to kill Mayor Cermak as an act of vengeance. The famous 1930s columnist, Walter Winchell, for one, believe this rumor to be true. The warden of the prison that held Zangara had a different opinion. He told his guards to write down everything the assassin said, and himself questioned Zangara over a period of 10 days. He concluded that the assassin was neither insane nor a conspirator, but had acted alone. The shooting was fully investigated by federal agents, and they could find no link between Zangara and the Chicago mob. Author Blaise Pitchy concluded, "The question of a government cover-up might arise, but there's no credible evidence to justify such a cover-up." The opposite seems to be true. If the Secret Service, the FBI, or the Miami police had discovered that Zangara had links to organized crime, terrorist groups, or foreign governments, it seems certain that these links would have been hotly pursued. Apparently, this line of inquiry came to nothing. Pitchy also concluded that, if Zangara had been hired to kill Cermak, why would he do it in the midst of one of the largest crowds ever to gather in Miami history? Cermak had a home in Miami Beach and was vacationing there. That fact would have offered many opportunities for a mob hit. Pitchy believes Zangara's likely motive was both political and personal. Zangara was in constant pain from an intestinal ailment, and an acquaintance of his testified that Zangara was suicidal over his dwindling finances and had thought about jumping off a bridge or injecting himself with poison. Pitchy believes it plausible that Zangara thought he could kill two birds with one stone, commit suicide, and at the same time become famous as a champion of the downtrodden. Within a week of the Zangara shooting, the Secret Service was hot on the trail of a copycat would-be assassin who sent a package in the mail addressed to the president-elect. The package, postmarked Watertown, New York, broke open in a Washington, D.C. post office. The bomb consisted of a shotgun shell with writing over the cap. Postal authorities said that it had a 1 in 10 chance of exploding, and then only after being dropped in a perpendicular position. An accompanying note read, "Dear Roosevelt, I want to congratulate you for escaping gunman Zangara. Yours, Paul Autroni." The same day, a letter arrived at police headquarters in Watertown, which read in part, "My friend Zangara missed Roosevelt. I take his place to get rid of him." While Roosevelt tried not to express alarm about previous attempts on his life, he did become more security conscious during the Second World War. According to those close to him, he used to talk about what a 25-pound bomb could do to his house in Hyde Park, New York. Special protection was understandably afforded to Roosevelt during the Second World War to thwart any would-be Axis assassin. The size of the presidential detail reached 16 agents and two supervisors by 1939. After the U.S. entered the war, leading to Roosevelt attending war conferences in Canada, North Africa, Iran, and Yalta, the detail was increased to 37 men. Before the war, the White House grounds had been open to the public, welcoming as many as 15,000 persons a day. Visitors could walk up to the front door and leave a message for the president, drivers could pass by the North Portico, and anyone could walk through the North White House grounds without a pass or any challenge from the Secret Service. After the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, access to the White House was severely restricted. Gates were closed, tourists were banned, and armed soldiers assisted the Secret Service in guarding the executive mansion. Invited guests to the White House and dignitaries who met the president on his tours around the country were told to keep their hands out of their pockets. FDR's food was also carefully tested in case Nazi agents tried to poison him. On one occasion, a fish sent from Cuba was found to be poisoned, but the Secret Service was unable to track down the sender of the package. There was also a number of breaches in the security around the White House. Threats that in peacetime might have been ignored or received light sentences were judged more severely during the war, even before the United States entered it. After one man, diagnosed as being a constitutional psychopath, Edward Blount, told acquaintances on two occasions he was going to kill the president, he was arrested and given a 2 to 6 year prison sentence. In a similar case in 1943, a known Nazi sympathizer, William Thomas Reed, was convicted of threatening the life of the president, a federal offense, for telling an associate in the oil business, "President Roosevelt is one guy I hate. If I had the money, I would go to Washington and kill the president, and if you ever come south, I will. These were fighting words, but more dangerous, perhaps, was Christopher Clarence Cole from Oklahoma, a racist who believed Hitler was the greatest man in the world. Cole told friends he wanted to go to Germany, volunteer for special training in sabotage, and then return to the United States to blow up ships and aircraft factories. Shortly after the Japanese bombing of Pearl Harbor, Cole enlisted as a sailor in the United States Navy, but deserted from the USS Florida when it docked at Para, Brazil. Cole made his way back to America and visited a friend, Dick Siebert, in Belmore, Long Island. Cole told Siebert he was going to manufacture a nitroglycerin bomb and get close to Roosevelt and blow him to hell and I'll go along with him. Siebert unsuccessfully tried to persuade Cole to abandon his plans, calling the idea preposterous. According to Siebert, Cole was determined to carry out his assassination plan. When Cole left Siebert's house, he traveled to New York City and registered at a hotel, carrying a case of nitroglycerin. Siebert and his mother immediately contacted the police. Siebert said Cole had nearly enough nitroglycerin to blow up a battleship. He's a clever mechanic and knows exactly how to make a bomb. He hates Roosevelt and our form of government. He's desperate and really intends to carry out the threat, said Siebert. The Secret Service began a manhunt for Cole. A background investigation revealed that Cole had abandoned his wife, deserted from the U.S. Army before deserting for the Navy, been arrested for an armed robbery in Tulsa, escaped from a mental asylum in Oklahoma, and had been indicted for stabbing a shipmate, but had managed to escape police custody. Secret Service agents discovered Cole had taken a room at a New York hotel. The service occupied a room directly opposite and arrested him on his return in the early hours of the next morning. Cole was armed with a 16-inch long butcher's knife. In his room, they found bomb-making materials. At another hotel, where Cole had rented a room, they found a black suitcase containing two bottles of nitroglycerin and a bottle of nitric acid. Cole was taken to the New York City police headquarters. He first denied it, but then admitted that his purpose was to kill that son-of-a-bitch Roosevelt. I wanted to destroy him in order that we can get a new commander-in-chief who will make peace with Germany and then go after the Japanese. I hate President Roosevelt. He was responsible for our entry into the war and the killing of a great many sailors in the North Atlantic. Cole's signed confession stated that he planned to strap three nitroglycerin bombs to his waist. He would wear an army uniform to get close to Roosevelt's car as the president exited the White House, and then, he said, blow myself and the president to bits and also kill any Secret Service agents or other people who are nearby. After Cole was sent to a psychiatric hospital, he continued to threaten to kill Roosevelt and told staff he would have no difficulty escaping from the institution. The Secret Service responded by insisting Cole be sent to a more secure hospital, the Matteawan State Hospital for the Criminally Insane in Beacon, New York. Arguably the most serious threat to President Roosevelt's life occurred shortly before the president set sail for the Tehran-Cairo War Conference. In early November 1943, an armed stalker waited for FDR for 10 days in Lafayette Park, across the street from the White House. The would-be assassin was Walter Harold Best, 38-year-old native of Nelson, Wisconsin. After arriving in Michigan in 1938, Best married and became the father of two small children. He was variously employed as a farmhand, a magazine salesman, and at a restaurant. Although he did not serve in the Army during the Second World War, he had a brother who served in Italy. On November 2, 1943, Best left his home in Pontiac, Michigan, armed with a loaded .38-caliber revolver and 10 additional rounds of ammunition. He arrived in Washington, D.C. on November 3rd and registered at the Congress Hotel. He wrote a letter to his wife, telling her that he intended to get rid of Roosevelt. He had learned that the president was out of town, but he intended to await his return. Best's statement that the president at the time was out of town was correct. The president had left the White House and traveled by train to Hyde Park on October 29th and did not return to Washington until November 4th. Best spent the period of November 3rd to November 13th observing the comings and goings of White House staff. He walked around Lafayette Park across the street from the executive mansion, hoping to get a pot shot at the president when FDR left the White House to attend a church or carry out one of his official duties. He was also aware that Roosevelt was often driven in an open limousine and sometimes drove himself in a convertible. The fabric tops of convertibles reinforced to repel grenades, but FDR often drove with the tops down. There were certainly many opportunities during this period for Best to carry out his attack. On November 6th, 2 days after his return from Hyde Park, the president drove to Camp David and returned to the White House the following day. On November 10th, he was motored to the National Airport from the White House to meet his returning Secretary of State, Cordell Hull, and returned to the White House at 4 p.m. At 10:40 a.m. on November 11th, the Secret Service protectors drove him to Arlington National Cemetery for a wreath-laying ceremony at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier, returning at 11 a.m. At 9:30 p.m., that same day, FDR left the White House to travel by motor car to Quantico, where he boarded the USS Potomac for the first leg of his sea journey to the Tehran-Cairo Conference. The dangers of Roosevelt traveling in an open-top convertible weren't lost on Kenneth B. Seckel, who was a captain of the White House police force. Seckel recalled driving one day from Hyde Park, FDR's mother's apartment in New York, that, "My God, we had about 20% of the police force of New York City involved in the president's protection, and I got out of his car, and there were 1,000 people all over the neighborhood. I said to one of the Secret Service men, if anyone wanted to take a pot shot, there wasn't much that could be done." In Best's letter to his wife, he told her that he had infiltrated a group of soldiers who were unloading a truck at a White House gate. He said the soldiers were busy, which made it possible for him to gain access to the White House. However, as he deliberated whether or not to steal a soldier's rifle lying on the ground nearby, he was discovered and he quickly walked away. Best's account was partially confirmed in 1966 when former Secret Service Director Franklin Wilson said an unnamed would-be assassin had stolen a rifle from White House Army sentries, and the next day it was found in a flower box at the back of the State Department building. The soldiers were severely disciplined for their serious lapse of duty. Best's wife contacted the police, who relayed her information to the Secret Service on November 13th. That same day, Best was ticketed for jaywalking, was abusive to the police officer, and was arrested. At the police station, he was identified as wanted by the Secret Service. Best was not armed when he was arrested, but Secret Service agents soon discovered the pistol and bullets in his hotel room. During his interrogation, Best admitted he had been stalking President Roosevelt. "I had electrodes running through my brain," he told agents, "and they told me to get rid of Roosevelt." On November 23, 1943, 10 days after his arrest, Best was judged insane and sent to Gallinger Hospital in Washington before being sent to a Michigan psychiatric hospital.
Hey everyone, Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors.
Well, troubles for FDR weren't over, and really they wouldn't be throughout the rest of his presidency. On November 14th, one day after Best was arrested, FDR was nearly killed when he was aboard the USS Iowa, bound for the Tehran-Cairo Conference. Around 8 a.m., during an air defense drill, there was a shattered explosion close by the battleship. The Iowa's captain saw the wake of a torpedo and promptly heeled his ship to port, making a 90-degree turn. The torpedo missed the ship by only 20 feet. Fearing that German submarines were attacking, the president's security detail prepared to take the president off the ship in a lifeboat if necessary. But a few minutes later, an escort ship reported that a live torpedo had been fired by accident. Were it not for the alert captain's maneuver, the torpedo would have struck the Iowa directly below FDR's quarters. According to Soviet agents, Waffen-SS commander Otto Skorzeny, Hitler's favorite cloak-and-dagger operative, also had Roosevelt in his sights. Skorzeny allegedly had been given the mission of assassinating FDR, Winston Churchill, and Joseph Stalin when the Big Three met for a conference in Tehran in November 1943. Tehran had been chosen by Stalin because it was close to the Soviet Union and the Red Army bases of northern Iran. But Tehran had also been rife with German agents eager to tap into anti-British sentiment. Stalin informed Roosevelt of the plot, codenamed Operation Long Jump, and persuaded FDR to stay at the Russian embassy, where he said it was safer. In Tehran, U.S. General Herbert Norman Schwarzkopf and his British counterpart, Colonel Joseph Spencer, put their subordinates on alert for Skorzeny's assassins. All but six of the 38 German commandos who had parachuted into Tehran were quickly rounded up. The remainder were captured 3 months later. All were executed by the Russians. Roosevelt said the plot, if successful, would have been a pretty good haul, and Churchill was excited, even pleased, when he heard his life had been threatened. He looked into everyone's face with the happiest sort of suspicions. Well, not everyone believed the plot was real. America's ambassador to the Soviet Union, Averell Harriman, suspected the Russians had cooked it up. Additionally, the British Joint Intelligence Committee of the War Cabinet concluded the so-called Nazi plot against the Big Three was complete baloney. Initially, Skorzeny himself denied the existence of any such plot, and many Western historians have always been skeptical. But Skorzeny eventually admitted the plot in 1966, and Russian sources continue to insist that the plot really existed. In 2007, one of the KGB operatives involved in the attempt to stop the alleged assassination plot stated flatly, "The success of our group in locating the Nazi advance party and our subsequent actions thwarted an attempt to assassinate the Big Three." Well, Roosevelt didn't die from the bullet of an assassin, but from all the stress he had undertaken as a war president. In April 1945, FDR went south to his Warm Spring house in Georgia, what he called the Little White House, to try to recover his strength. He was accompanied by his friend, Elizabeth Chamadoff, an artist who was to paint his portrait. On the morning of April 12th, FDR complained to his doctor of a slight headache and stiffness in his neck. As he posed for his picture and spoke to his mistress, Lucy Rutherford, he went through his wallet and tossed his draft card in the wastebasket. He carried it with him throughout the war. "I have a terrific headache," he said, and then slumped forward. Roosevelt died 2 hours later in his small bedroom. All right, well, that's all for this episode. In the next episode, we're going to be looking at a president, codenamed Lancer, who is John F. Kennedy, and see what sort of assassination attempts were happening against him. What sort of domestic assassins rose up? Was the Soviet Union trying to assassinate him? Why was he successfully assassinated when so many other presidents weren't? And as you can see, there have been many near misses that have happened. We'll see you and discuss all that in the next episode. All right, well, that was the episode for today. Thank you so much for listening, and I hope you enjoyed it. First of all, I'd like to thank the Knowlton's Rangers, and especially our spymasters, Baron Freyza, Carl from Norway, Chris from Maine, Moondoggy from Ohio, and Rick Knowlton, and I'll explain what that means in a second. If you want to support the show and help me keep producing this content, there are four easy ways for you to do it. One, subscribe to the show and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. If you want to do that, you can go to historyunplugpodcast.com and there you'll find instructions. Two, join our Facebook group, which you can find if you just search for History Unplugged. And please like and share posts that I put up about new episodes. Three, submit a question to me so that I can answer it on air. You can email me at info@historyonthenet.com or leave a voicemail. And again, go to historyunplugpodcast.com and you'll find instructions. Lastly, and I think this one is the best, is to become one of the Knowlton's Rangers. The Knowlton's Rangers were an elite reconnaissance and espionage detachment of the Continental Army in the Revolutionary War, but it's also the name of the History Unplugged membership program. Learn how to join by going to patreon.com/unplugged. So here's what you get if you become one of the Knowlton's Rangers. If you join at the level of Scout, you can get early access to new podcast episodes, along with enjoying absolutely every single episode of the History Unplugged podcast ad-free, all 270 and counting episodes. If you join at the level of Intelligence Officer, you can also get access to premium episodes, like a multi-part series on the life of Audie Murphy, the most decorated combat soldier in World War II, or the 10-part series Ottoman Lives, a series that looks at the cast of characters that made up the Ottoman Empire, such as the Sultan, the Eunuch, the Harem Servant Girl, and the Soldier. And finally, if you join at the level of Spymaster, you get all the same stuff as the Scouts and Intelligence Officers, but you also get a shout-out to you and or your business at the end of each episode, a 3-pack of hardcover history books, plus you'll be put at the very front of the line for me to answer your question about history, and I can guarantee I will dedicate an episode that's about an hour long or so to your question. Sign up at patreon.com/unplugged. Again, that's patreon.com/unplugged. Anyway, those are the ways you can help out the show. Thank you so much for your support. Thanks for listening to the History Unplugged podcast. Be sure to subscribe to the show to get your daily dose of all things history related, from ancient Greece to the Cold War. We'll see you next time at the History Unplugged podcast.